This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, give language a bit of a zhuzh. Zhuzh it up a bit. Today's episode is about a language. Or maybe it's an argot, slang, a cant, possibly even an anti-language. A code to signal to some people and keep secrets from others. On with the show. In 1982, Princess Anne, the second child of the Queen of England, Olympic equestrian, is competing at the badminton horse trials.
She's on her horse and she's jumping over all of these obstacles. And oops, she slips and falls in the water of an obstacle. And all the photographers rush forward to take a photograph. And she tells them to naff off. Or naff off.
Well, she's not allowed to drop an F-bomb, really.
No.
She's royal.
But naff was a Polari word.
Polari. Just a couple of decades before, it would have been unthinkable that someone like Princess Anne would have used a Polari word, or that she would have even known one.
I'm Paul Baker, I'm Professor of English Language at Lancaster University.
And Paul started studying Polari in the mid-1990s, interviewing some of the last known surviving speakers, and along the way, compiling a dictionary of Polari and gay slang, and writing his new book, Fabulosa, The Story of Polari, Britain's Secret Gay Language.
What does the word Polari mean?
It means to speak or to talk or to say. It's very close to an Italian word, which has a very similar meaning, and that's where it comes from.
Polari.
Polari, that's it, yeah. And you have like Polari pipes, which is a telephone, for example, and you can use it as a noun or as a verb to refer to speech generally, or you can use it to refer to the language Polari too. So it has multifaceted uses.
Quite a few words came through Polari into wider slang, such as zhuzh, to spruce up one's hair or clothing, scarpa, to escape, bevy, a drink, clobber, clothes, slap, meaning makeup, carsy, toilet, cottaging, cruising for sex in men's public toilets. Camp and drag probably found their way into more general parlance via Polari. Polari usage was at its peak in the 1950s, when homosexuality was illegal in Britain, so gay men might use Polari words to find each other and communicate with each other.
It could be used as a way of identifying potential people who you thought might be gay. So if you met somebody maybe introduced for the first time and you suspected maybe they were gay too, you could use a Polari word or phrase, you know, a word like camping or something in a certain context. And if they responded with another word in Polari, then you'd know that it was kind of safe and you could talk to them. And if they didn't, then, you know, they probably wouldn't notice anyway and no face would be lost. So there was that contact way, almost like a secret handshake. But I think once established on the gay scene, it became a way of communicating much more extensively, often in quite public spaces. So the idea of a safe space in those days is just moot. There wasn't really anything like that. Even the gay bars could be raided quite easily, so they weren't particularly safe. But if you're in public, say on the tube or a bus or in a shop, people could talk in Polari and they could, you know, talk about the people who were present without them realising that they were being spoken about. Although you did have to be careful about the context. I had one speaker tell me about he'd been on a holiday to Italy with a friend. They were in a shoe shop. The chap who was measuring their shoes, who worked there, was very good looking. And they talked about him in Polari. And the chap understood it and said, thank you. And everybody in the shop had understood it because Polari and Italian are quite similar. So it was very embarrassing. And the guy had run out of the shop in shame. So check your etymologies, I think, before you start using Polari.
And yet that's so difficult because presumably there wasn't like a dictionary or a textbook to learn it. It seems amazing to me that people learn such an extensive amount just from personal interactions.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know how many people knew Polari?
It's really hard. There wasn't a census taking, and I've tried to estimate based upon projections. So thinking about how many people were in the UK in say the early 60s, how many of those would have been adults, so you've got a subset of those, and then how many of those would be on some kind of LGBT spectrum or Klein, how many of those would have felt comfortable enough to actually be out, and then how many of those would have been comfortable enough to actually kind of meet other gay people in the places where Polari may have been spoken in sort of larger cities and groups. And then you get sort of down to a case of people may have known it but not used it. Because if you're using it, you were definitely kind of indexing a quite a camp identity that not everybody wanted to be part of.
Or even knew that they could be part of.
Yeah, or knew that they could. So it's going down and down and down, and you're getting to maybe the low tens of thousands, I think.
Was it just used by gay men, or was it used by lesbians and like queer people, or...?
I think gay men were the kind of the center of it, and it wasn't just any, you know, not every gay man used it. It was men who were more likely to be working class, in certain types of professions, and probably had a more camp way of presenting themselves. Possibly men who would be now defined as maybe genderqueer or non-binary would use it. Women did use it, but often I think they would use it if they had friendship networks that included those kinds of men in it, and that could include straight and gay women as well. But I don't think they were maybe the central users, unless they had friends who were these kinds of men.
Do you have any idea of approximately the size of the lexicon?
Again, another interesting, complicated question that doesn't have an easy answer. Of the people I interviewed, there were some shared words, maybe about 20 to 30 shared words that they all knew. And then there were words that maybe only a few people knew, because obviously everyone was kind of using it on their own terms and their own friendship groups, and they were adding new words to it all the time and developing words. So the dictionary that I collected has about 400 words in it, but I think it's very unlikely that any of the speakers would have known all of those words. The dictionary is more like a sort of digging down in the earth and seeing layers of words on top of layer after layer at different time periods or different places or different social groups associated with different occupations, such as being in the Navy versus the theatre.
Is there much in writing?
No. Another issue I had with researching this was it was so hard to get actual data. So because it was this secret spoken language and people didn't write it down and there weren't any standards, sometimes you get, you know, inconsistencies, and it's very unclear sometimes how a word should be spelled or what it actually meant or how many people used it.
Speakers would mix Polari words in with English in varying amounts, sometimes just a sprinkle, sometimes whole sentences.
For most speakers, it wasn't a full language. It was a vocabulary of mainly nouns, verbs and adjectives that were very much based around everyday objects and people and body parts and clothing and things like that, and evaluating people and body parts and clothing, and some words for sex as well. And people would throw those words in replace of English words, but they'd quite heavily rely on English grammatical rules as well. And one interesting thing about Polari was that the ones who were very good at it were very good at ad-libbing, making up new words on the spot, changing existing words to make them even more complicated sounding so people who knew it wouldn't even know what was going on.
Polari was adaptable because it was a hodgepodge of many other languages. A lot of Italian, in, for example, the word Polari itself, and the numbers, una, due, tre, buona notte, good night. There were bits of French, bijou, for something little, Irish, in the word dolly, which meant pretty or nice, Yiddish, in schmutter for clothing, tush for bottom. Often Polari is attributed to Romani, but Paul's not convinced that there is a direct link. And then there's English in it too, Cockney rhyming slang, plates, feet, from plates of meat, barnet, hair, from barnet fair. And there's backslang, words backwards, ria for hair. Face became ecaf, and its abbreviation eek. Polari may be a small language, but the influences are broad.
Oh, it's all over the place. It was such a struggle, I think, to pick these apart. And, you know, I've done the best job I can, but you're going back, you know, a few hundred years, and records were not kept very well, if at all. A lot of the people who spoke these earlier forms of language, which fed into Polari, were viewed as criminal or on the edge of society in some way. They didn't speak a standard form of language, so records were not really kept about them.
Polari can be traced back to Cant, an earlier secret language used mostly by criminals in the 1500s to 1700s. Also around 1710, there emerged a group of men known as mollies,
who have sex with each other. They meet at what are called molly houses. They dress in drag. That word isn't a thing then. And they call each other female names, and they have their own slang words for cruising and sex and things like that. And around the same time, you have these societies of reformation of manners, and they really hate these mollies, and they arrange these prosecutions of them. Some of them are put in the stocks, some of them are hung, the molly houses are raided, quite a few of the mollies end up in prison. And you get this crossover between Molly words and the criminal cant at the time as well. So you have this kind of merging of these two things together. And then as the 18th century goes on into the 19th century, you start to get something called parliori, which is a slang used by beggars, peddlers, people who are kind of in travelling marketplaces called cheapjacks, fairgrounds and circus people, things like that. And they're using this parliori, which has a lots of words to do with the trade that they're in. There are words for money and numbers, lodgings, things like that as well. And I think from this parliori, it starts to become associated with the language of entertainment. And then from that, you find your way into the 19th century music halls, and then later the theatre and the West End.
The West End of London was one of the hotbeds of parliori because of the theatres there and the nightlife, and also the Dilly Boys, sex workers who traded in that area. The other part of London where parliori developed from was the East End, where you got the languages of the communities in that part of the city, such as the Yiddish and the Cockney rhyming slang, mixed into the languages of the docks to make a different strand of parliori.
Which is a more nautical strand to do with language that was spoke around the Mediterranean Sea, which is generally referred to as a lingua franca. And it's this kind of simplified language, which is a mixture of, say, Turkish and Italian, maybe a few other things thrown in, used to communicate around different ports. So you start to get bits of that coming in to parliori as well. And there's lots of Italian coming in as well, because you've got these Italian people who are entertainers coming over to the UK. And it kind of all just blends together into this thing that gradually coalesces much later on in the later 19th century and early 20th century into what became parliori, and then gradually gets started to be used more and more by gay men who were either working as sailors or they're looking for sailors, cruising the docks for sailors, or they're working in music halls and theatres, often in the chorus line as a dancer, things like that.
The East End and West End versions of parliori were a bit different, the former having more of the maritime-related vocabulary, the latter more theatrical influence. But neither is fixed, and it's difficult to know whether parliori was different again in other places. The geographical spread is hard to gauge because, as aforementioned, it is not a well-documented language. It did turn up in other British cities that were big or had docks, such as Manchester, Liverpool, Glasgow, but London was parliori's main home. And by the 1930s through the 1950s, its predominant use was by gay men for clandestine communication.
It was quite a kind of scary time. Homosexuality was illegal, and you could be arrested for being gay. And this could involve just something like smiling and winking at somebody as you pass them in the street. And if they were a kind of an undercover policeman, that could sometimes be enough. Or going out and wearing maybe a flamboyant scarf and a bit of blusher if you were a man. You know, those kinds of things would be enough to get you followed and harassed. So quite an intimidating time. The police were very unsympathetic if you were attacked by members of the public. I mean, they were often trying to entrap gay men anyway. They were easy targets. They were often just horrified at being caught and cooperative and ashamed and humiliated. And they didn't fight back. And, you know, it was part of that moral panic of the 50s that was going on.
In this oppressive time, parliori acted as what can be called an anti-language.
Anti-languages are not full languages, but they're forms of language that are used by these groups who are seen as anti-society in some way. And they're used to kind of express the concerns or interests of the society, but also to keep outsiders out, and also to kind of present this hostile front almost to outsiders as well, by reconceptualizing concepts very differently. So I think this was one of those maybe tools or techniques that helped people cope with these few decades that were quite tough to be gay. And I think it was more than just a kind of a way of being secret. It was almost like there was an attitude associated with the language as well, which made it deeper than just a set of words. Older gay men would often teach it to younger gay men, sometimes almost literally sitting around and giving lessons in all the words to people when they first started coming onto the gay scene, or when they joined the Merchant Navy. You know, there's a very camp attitude about using parliori. And I think, considering the context of the time, that people could be arrested and beaten up, I think parliori helped them to put on a brave face to kind of show that they didn't care so much, that even when they did, you didn't act like you cared. So you made a joke of things, and you maybe emphasized something trivial like the state of someone's makeup, or whether their wig was on askew, rather than getting upset about something which maybe would be seen as much more tragic, like being arrested. A nice example is so many words for the police, words like Lily Law, Betty Bracelets, Hilda Handcuffs. One I heard quite recently was, is Beryl with a badge, for example. And
as long as it alliterates.
It alliterates or rhymes in some way, which is another nice aspect of kind of memorable slang. But the point about those words is they're effeminizing. And, you know, I said them and you laughed. And it kind of makes the police not seem as threatening and intimidating if you're calling them Lily Law.
But then also I'm thinking, why was being female, being, you know, so bad?
Exactly. I mean, there was a whole other side, I think, of Polari where, I mean, and this is one of the reasons, I think, why it started to die out, because it was seen as quite politically incorrect, quite cruel at times, even though there's this cohesive, matey kind of side to it where kind of you're helping each other. But they were quite good at spotting a way of maybe focusing on someone's weakness and pulling them down using it.
Well, to be fair to them, I think if the law was telling me that I'm not supposed to exist, that would make me pretty angry.
I think so, yeah.
Not necessarily like super accommodating.
Yeah, I think their anger is valid, to be honest. Sometimes it came out in quite ugly ways. And I think sometimes as well, they'd been given so much abuse growing up, particularly the ones who could be guessed that they were gay because they were quite camp and non-gender conforming. I think they often responded with that abuse, and sometimes they got in first and did it first. And, you know, so many of my speakers talked about these brittle, acid-tongued queens who were just so witty and quick and sharp and quite terrifying in a way. But I think it was that form of attack that was actually defense. We shouldn't view them as saints or, you know, martyrs who kind of withstood this terrible oppression and always an incredibly noble and brave way, and they should all be given medals. But they weren't the sinners either that they were made out to be. They were human beings, and they were ordinary, and they were living in a time that was different to our own and had very different values and ways of speaking and understanding. So I don't want to put them on a pedestal and say they were amazing. They lived through times, and the ones who spoke Polari and were out, I think, were bold and brave, and I do wonder whether or not I would have been as bold and as brave as them if I'd lived through that time, or would I have crept into the closet and married a woman and had children and taken that route? And I don't know. I wasn't put through that test.
But in the 1960s, Polari was no longer this secret language. It was being broadcast to up to 15 million people a week on one of the BBC's most popular radio shows, Round the Horn, a comedy sketch show featuring amongst its recurring characters the out-of-work actors Julian and Sandy. At the end of every episode, they'd be visited by the show's star, Kenneth Horne, in a new business establishment. Bona Books, Bona Antiques, Bona Law, Bona Dance School.
And they used this Polari in it.
Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian. This is my friend Sandy.
Oh! Oh! Well, why, it's Mr. Horne. Oh, our Bona to Vardyarique again. Brings you trolling into this shrine of Terpsichore.
Do you spot the Polari in the clip? How bona to vada your eek again, how good to see your face again, and trolling was walking.
They didn't use a lot of it, but they used enough, I think, to make it distinct. They used it in a way where you could often guess what the words were, but not always.
When Round the Horn was putting this language on air, that was pretty unprecedented, wasn't it?
Totally, totally. And they were operating under the baleful watch of Mary Whitehouse.
Britain's self-selected watchdog against liberalism, blasphemy, profanity, and anything she deemed obscene, Mary Whitehouse.
Who couldn't stand swearing or references to sex. She'd written this piece in the newspaper a few years earlier, kind of advising mothers on what to do to not have a gay son and how to make their son not gay. So she was quite homophobic. And she did complain about Round the Horn. She complained about another sketch, which she viewed as quite sacrilegious, although it didn't include Julian and Sandy. But she never complained about Julian and Sandy. And I think part of the reason why she didn't was because they used Polari to kind of disguise a lot of the sexual content of the discussion in a way which would have just been maybe too complicated for her to have to deal with. You know, if she'd said, oh, I don't like their use of this word, then there would have been questions, you know, how does Mary know what Polari words are? Where does she pick it up? So maybe she just left it alone and it escaped.
Too incriminating.
Exactly, yeah. So she never complained about it. And they got away with it. And there was some quite rude stuff in there when you start to decipher it.
Julian and Sandy were played by gay actors Hugh Paddock and Kenneth Williams, and hearing them chat in Polari had given the writers the idea to use it in the sketches. But those writers, Barry Took and Marty Feldman, weren't gay, so they weren't really conversant in the language themselves. They scripted a simplified version of it, so it didn't confuse the listeners who were unfamiliar with Polari. There wasn't even that much Polari in the sketches, only about 2.5% of the words. But still, Round the Horn took Polari beyond the theatres, the docks, the private discourse of gay men, and put it into the mainstream for the first time, which contributed to Polari's decline.
Although by the late 60s, some of the people I spoke to said it was kind of already starting to be seen as old-fashioned by that point, and in a sense, Julian and Sandy's use of it was more like a kind of swan song, you know, an encore of the language, rather than actually representing something that was happening a great deal in the late 60s by that point. It was already on the way out, I think.
I suppose if something had been in use 30 years before, then if you were a young man, you'd be like, well, that's for granddad.
Exactly. There was this age thing about it. I mean, one of my favourite Polari words is black market queen or BMQ. And this is a very British term. It refers to the black market and World War II and the sort of underground world of purchasing goods and things like that. And it was used in context, particularly in the Navy, where there'd be somebody on the ship who was gay, but kind of undercover about it, didn't let on. And he'd sneak around cabins at nighttime, you know, looking for men to have sex with. It was all very covert, gossiped about. People often knew who it was, but these people were called black market queens. And now we say someone's in the closet, which is another Americanism.
It'd be in the wardrobe.
Yeah, exactly, wouldn't it? I know, come out of the wardrobe. And, you know, if you're talking about black market queens in the 1960s and 70s, you're using World War II slang. You sound old. And that's not going to impress, you know, many people, I think, except maybe me. And then, you know, 1967, you have the partial decriminalisation. And you have this younger, newer generation of gay men and lesbians who are coming out. And they're part of a very different worldview. They want liberation. And they have gay pride. And they go on marches. And Polari is the secrecy thing, is the kind of antithesis of that, really. And it starts to be seen as surplus to requirements, a time associated with older people, a language associated with a quite a sad time that needs to be pushed aside and left behind, really. And so in the 1970s, you just have this huge cultural shift from within people in the UK, where camp is starting to be seen as quite problematic because it's seen as aping women, so it's quite sexist. Camp is seen as very apolitical at best and politically incorrect at worst. It's not going to get you more rights, particularly because the public quite like camp characters like John Inman in All You've Been Served and Larry Grayson in The Generation Game. They're kind of sexless and harmless and silly and stereotyping and safe in a way. And gay people at the time were saying, no, we're not all like that. Most of us are not like that. We're not stereotypes and caricatures. We're not comedy figures. We deserve better representation. So you have this shift, this dislike of camp. And with that, a dislike of Polari. And you know, that's, I think, another reason why it's starting to die out.
And the likes of Princess Anne using it didn't help.
When the establishment, the elite are using, then it loses, you know, its kind of subcultural underground credibility quite quickly.
Yeah, that's going to kill it instantly. Yeah.
My personal rule is I can't use slang if my mum uses it or if I have to look up what it means on Urban Dictionary.
Each generation has to find its own identity to distinguish itself from the generation above, so it doesn't just appear like a copy or it's not old in a way. Slang always needs to revive and refresh every few years.
And in the 1970s, much of the new slang was coming from the USA, as cheap transatlantic flights meant large numbers of gay men travelling from Britain to San Francisco, New York and Los Angeles, and bringing back different clothes and hairstyles and vocabulary. But Polari didn't completely go away. It was in the performances of Lee Sutton, a popular drag queen in the late 1960s and 70s. It appeared in a 1973 episode of Doctor Who, and the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, an LGBTQ charity and protest organisation that was founded in San Francisco in 1979. They got hold of Polari.
They are conducting ceremonies, things like house blessings, canonisations of high-profile LGBT people, even partnership ceremonies. And this is before, in the 1990s, before these things were kind of legalised. And, you know, religions are traditionally not particularly welcoming towards gay people. So these sisters have this role where they're providing a kind of a space to be spiritual for gay people, which can also be quite a fun and camp space as well. And they start using Polari in these ceremonies. They say that it's kind of a bit like Latin is to Catholic people. It's this dead language, which is semi-incomprehensible, and it gives their ceremonies this sort of mystical, strange quality to it, which I think it does. And I think they start to stem a kind of revival of interest in it.
The Manchester, UK chapter of the Sisters even translated the Bible into Polari in 2003. Then in 2004, the legendary Soho cabaret club Madame Jojo's hired Paul Baker here to train the waitstaff to use Polari. And over the 21st century, Paul has seen clothing, art pieces, cocktails, cafes, magazines, named with or making reference to Polari.
So you get this kind of revival, and as a result of that, you get all these people kind of becoming interested in it, and there's been enough distance from gay liberation, I think, for it to be reevaluated, and a sense now that we're actually, maybe history and heritage mean something and matter. They shouldn't just be forgotten about.
But when it's making its way into people's discourse again, it's not necessarily the same as old Polari. Different grammar, different constructions, and different references, because it's not the 1950s anymore. This seems appropriate for Polari, which has always been eclectic and open for adaptation by its speakers.
Yes, definitely. You can add in any language to it, I think, if you want to. And I quite like the idea of having not just the language, but being able to draw upon the language and the camp attitude behind it. It's a kind of resource, I think. Everybody can have a bad day. And I think one of the things I admire about Polari speakers was their resilience and their ability to make a joke out of quite a bad situation. And I think that's maybe something that is good to be able to do, to have as one, maybe not always do it because it can be annoying, but to have it as one tool in their repertoire of coping strategies, to be able to laugh at the situation when something's going wrong. And also, I think, to be able to laugh at yourself when you don't meet your own expectations or other people's expectations, to not maybe hold yourself to too high a standard and not to take yourself too seriously. And that's something I think a lot of the Polari speakers did.
Paul Baker is a professor of English language at Lancaster University. His new book is Fabulosa, which goes into much greater detail about Polari and is extremely interesting. He's also written a dictionary of Polari and is involved with the Polari app, which you can get at polariapp.com. And coming up in today's mini-illusionist, Paul talks about some of his non-Polari linguistics work. In this case, analysis he did on the ways women worded their dating profiles.
I've done some stuff looking at personal adverts, you know, from different perspectives, collecting lots of these and then trying to see how people present themselves.
Yeah.
Very interesting differences. So gay women versus straight women. One difference is the straight women tend to describe themselves as having things done to them by hypothetical men. So things like, I would like you to make me happy, or I would like you to take me here or do this to me. And the gay women do not do that at all.
So they're like, I'd like to go here.
Yeah. Whereas the straight women are kind of almost like, not always, but there's a linguistic difference. It's statistically significant. They use this construction where it's like, do this to me, sort of, in different ways.
Right, so they've been cast as passive, or they've cast themselves as passive.
Yeah, and I think it's not that they're even acknowledging that they're doing it. And I missed it. It was the computer, you know, that spotted the word and said, look at this word, it's interesting. But it's one of those things, I think, where they've come across that kind of language so much. And when you write these adverts, you read them first anyway, don't you? And you get a sense of what the style is. So it just becomes this perpetuating thing. And it's so subtle that I don't even think, probably even the men are aware of it. No one's aware of it, but it's just there. And it's just this kind of grammatical inequality which is going on and sort of representative of a bigger thing.
Well, there's that broad sweep, isn't there, that women, it doesn't work out as well to be direct. You have to kind of minimise yourself a bit.
Yeah, definitely. So the gay women use we a lot, the word we, and like, we could do this together, we could go here. And, you know, I think we's a really interesting word for a relationship because it implies you're in a relationship if you're a we. And maybe straight women are thinking, straight men are not going to want to hear we at this stage. The straight men's ones I looked at were pretty horrible, actually, a lot of them, really shocking stuff. There was a lot of stuff in the male one about, I would like a woman who I can treat like a princess. Ugh. And loads of those, all kind of like variations of like, I want to spoil her, pamper her, I know what you want, I can look after you, women are beautiful creatures, they're goddesses, all this stuff, they need to be worshipped.
Or it's a real performance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of chivalry or whatever.
It's over the top. It can't last. Yeah. And no one can stay on that pedestal, so.
Or maybe she'll really act like a princess and tell you to naff off. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is skittily. Noun, a Spartan secret writing on a strip wound around a stick, unreadable without a stick of the same thickness. Try using it in an email today. I'll be emailing it to myself to remind me to look into it further. This episode of The Illusionist was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, thanks to Martin Austwick, who makes the music you hear on this show. Find his songs at palebirdmusic.com, and he's just started a podcast talking about how he writes music. That's called The Year of the Bird, and it's available in the podcast getting places. Next Illusionist is the 100th episode. If you want to contribute something to it, here's what you need to do. Fire up voice memo on your phone. Record yourself saying the best thing you've learned about language from The Illusionist. Then email the recording to illusionistshow@gmail.com. But the deadline is pressing. Thanks very much to all of you who've sent yours in already. I'm looking forward to getting into those as a 100th episode retreat to myself. And find out more about today's topic. See the full dictionary entry of the randomly selected word. Read episode transcripts. Find out when the Illusionist live show is coming to a venue near you. Follow the show on social media. And listen to every episode. That's all at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.